We'll hear arguments next in Scott against the United States. Mr. Charger, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, the minimization provision of Title III of the Armed Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968 provides that every order, an extension thereof, authorizing electronic surveillance shall contain a provision that the authorization to intercept shall be conducted in such a way as to minimize the interception of communications not otherwise subject to interception under this chapter.
I think the Court requested counsel to address the problem of standing. Is that correct?
Yes. There are three questions really before the Court in this appeal. First one is the meaning and interpretation and construction of the minimization provision of the federal wiretap statute. We feel that specifically the question is whether the Court below determined the correct standard and properly applied it to the conduct of the wiretap in this case. Related questions are also implicated. One is as to the scope of the remedy to be applied in the event of a violation of the minimization requirement, and that is whether full or partial suppression of the fruits of the wiretap are to be mandated. And thirdly, whether the petitioner Scott has standing to assert the violation. The standing question relates only to the petitioner Scott within the framework of the facts of this case. There is a related petition for writ of cert also arising from the circuit court opinion in this case, and that's the petition for Chloe Daviaj. And of course, her situation on the question of standing is the same as that of the petitioner Scott. The question of standing was fully briefed in Ms. Daviaj's petition in her brief as amicus, and we of course have fully researched and briefed the point of standing in our brief. I would say that insofar as standing, we think that the question was adequately and correctly answered by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the Belosi case, which was also an appeal from a wiretap ruling of the district court. And similarly, in the early opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case, referred to as Scott 1, the direct appeal in this case is from what is referred to throughout the briefs of the parties as Scott 2. But in Scott 1, the circuit court fully addressed the question of standing, and it determined that under the court's interpretation of the related provisions of Title III, the petitioner Scott clearly had standing to assert the violation of the minimization requirement. We feel that that was a correct analysis. The court's analysis of the question was a correct one, and certainly the court's conclusion, we feel, is amply justified by the language of the statute, which identifies aggrieved persons as one whose conversations are intercepted over the wiretap, and secondly, one against whom the interception is directed. On both questions, on both points, the petitioner Scott qualifies. Petitioner Scott was identified in the application for the wiretap, that is the affidavit of the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drug agent who applied for the wiretap, as being one of the principal targets. Though the order that was entered by the court in response to this application did not identify Scott particularly as one of the subjects, the order said, and said that the targets of the investigation, that the wiretap was authorized to intercept the conversations of Bernice Thurman, Alfonso Lee, and others. And, of course, for one to determine who the others might be insofar as what the record would show at that point, there were nine persons identified in the application as being the principal offenders. Scott was certainly a principal target of the investigation.
Well, perhaps you're coming to this, but let me put it to you now. Once it's determined from listening that approximately one-third of the calls relate to narcotics traffic, doesn't that have some give some impetus to continuing surveillance?
The entire question of minimization is a very difficult one. It cannot be resolved, we feel, by reference to percentages of narcotic-related calls.
Well, why not?
Not the question
of
minimization.
If a third of the conversations relate to illegal traffic in narcotics, how can it not bear on the continued surveillance?
Well, we feel that the question of minimization is related to a number of factors, the least one of which we would urge would be the percentage of narcotic-related calls. For instance, it would seriously relate to who it is who might use the phone, whether or not there has been developed over the course of the wiretap a pattern of clearly innocent calls between certain people who talk on the phone.
And, you say that the percentages aren't important, but what percentage of the total calls here do you regard as unrelated to narcotics?
We did not undertake an identification in the district court or in the Court of Appeals of a percentile breakdown.
You challenged the government's analysis of it?
What we relied on was the testimony of the agent who supervised the wiretap, that the perception of the agents who were listening to the wiretap and the reports that were made to him and reports that he in turn forwarded to the attorney in charge of the wiretap, that roughly 40% of the calls were narcotic related. This was his testimony at the motion to suppress hearing that was held in the district court in April of 1971. Judge Waddy, the judge who presided at that particular hearing, adopted that finding. And as a matter of fact, he made it the basis of the ruling that he ultimately entered suppressing the wiretap, that though there was testimony that 40% of the calls were narcotic-related, 60% of the calls were not. There was no effort, absolutely no effort, made on the part of any of the agents conducting the wiretap to minimize the interception of any telephone call.
How would you go about minimizing that, Mr. Shorter, once you found out that 40% were clearly narcotics-related, 30%, 39% were so ambiguous they couldn't tell, and how do you minimize from there on?
Well, When we say that some of the calls were so ambiguous that they could not be, that you couldn't tell what they related to, we think that that's a determination that was made by Mr. Kellogg, our adversary in the case. The agents who compiled daily records and reports of the calls that were being made over the telephone, using their own judgment, using their own instincts, referring to the logs of the call that they created at the time that the calls were made, was passing the information along to Mr. Cooper, the supervising agent. Mr. Cooper was reviewing their logs, he was reviewing their reports, and as the reports were going in, some days it would be 3 out of 6 calls were narcotic-related. Some days it would be 3 out of 19 calls. So that at the end, when we total up the number of calls that were intercepted, and incidentally all the calls on this particular telephone were intercepted over a 30-day period with no effort, with no phone call ever being not recorded and not heard by the agents. When he got to the end of the line, there was some compilation that Mr. Cooper testified to, and that was that, well, our conclusion was that 40% of the calls were narcotic-related. That was not the issue in the case. It wasn't a matter of percentages, although the percentages were important because a majority of the calls were not related, according to the judgment of the agents, to the narcotic enterprise. They were not narcotic-related conversations. Now, there were instances of calls being made over the phone which were challenged in the district court as being subject to some reasonable effort at minimization. And the statute that we're talking about, we submit, creates an affirmative duty on the part of the agents to conduct the wiretap. And this is the language of the statute. Conduct the wiretap in a way as to minimize the interception of calls not related to the criminal enterprise. In effect, that's what the statute says. So the statute creates a responsibility. It creates a responsibility United States attorney or the assistant who is supervising the tap, the supervising agent, and the agents who are actually doing the intercept. But even above that, it creates a responsibility.
Mr. Shorter, the statute doesn't say they have to eliminate calls not related to the criminal enterprise.
No. It says it shall minimize.
It doesn't use the words not related to the criminal enterprise. Not otherwise subject to interception.
Not otherwise subject to interception.
And they're all subject to interception because the court order authorized it.
All calls are not subject to interception.
Well, all of them during the 30-day period.
It gets a little circular, doesn't it?
It seems to be that way, but clearly if we're going to use as our starting point, what this court said in Berger and what this court said in Katz, we also use as our starting point the overriding and the compelling interests of privacy that must govern any approach to questions of wiretapping. This is an intrusion, and the whole purpose of the statute is to limit the intrusion.
Well, it's also to authorize the intrusion.
It authorizes an intrusion, yes. On a very particularized, on a very limited basis, and for very limited reasons. And the reasons are to gather evidence of criminality. That, it seems to me, is the purpose for which the wiretap is authorized. The wiretap is not authorized.
And they listen for a while, and they find that almost one out of every two calls has some evidence of criminality in it. When are they supposed to stop listening?
Well, it's a judgment that has to be formed by the officers who are conducting the wiretap. First off, they must have a design or a desire to follow the law. In this case, the court found that there was no purpose on the part of the agents, that their intercepting every call was done willfully and was done in violation of the order, simply because the supervising agent did not clearly instruct the agents as to what their responsibilities were.
Yes, they told them not to listen to lawyer-client calls, doctor-patient calls, and priest-penitent calls.
Yes, ones that were obviously privileged.
What else should he have told them?
Well, he should have told them that in the instance, after looking at the telephone calls between Geneva Thornton and her mother, that proceeded for several days.
And some of which contained reference to criminal activity.
No, it didn't.
Well, the government says they did.
They said
two or three of them referred to.
That is an error, because what the government, the only thing the government can say about any of the conversations between Geneva Jenkins and her mother was that in one of the conversations, the second conversation, the mother said to Geneva, Al called. She also said something about a person named Red's call. In response to a question that Geneva's mother asked about Bernice Thurman, the man that she was living with, where is Bernice? And she said that Bernice is out taking care of business. That's the gist of what the government points to.
Didn't she say that we don't talk about business on the phone to?
Well, that's the mother in a later conversation when the mother said, Geneva, I have something very important to tell you. This is another conversation. It doesn't have anything to do with this conversation about Bernice out taking care of business, which is what Geneva said to her mother when her mother said, well, where's Bernice? This is her common-law husband. This is just like any mother-in-law would say, well, where's your husband? Well, he's out taking care of business, whatever that may be. But that is not a narcotic-related conversation. And the conversation that you're now adverting to was a later conversation where the mother was saying to Geneva, there's something important that I want to say to you. All the conversations are deeply personal. This is a mother talking to her daughter, urging her daughter to leave the man that she's living with, bring your clothes. And as the conversations go on, they become, the personal nature of them are quite obvious. The mother says to Geneva, there's something I want to talk to you about. Now, who knows what it's about? I would submit that it was something personal. And Geneva said, well, what is it? And the mother said, well, it's something about business, and I don't want to talk about business over the telephone. Agent Cooper, during the first hearing, admitted that the agents had no reason to believe, no suspicion, that the mother was involved in any narcotics-related activity, that this was clearly what it was, obviously was, a mother calling, talking to her daughter, having battering kinds of conversations about family matters and other personal matters. Later, in the hearing that took place a couple of years later, after the Court of Appeals had reversed Judge Waddy for the first time, his testimony took a slightly different hue. And that was that after reading the transcript of the seven Geneva mother telephone calls, he believes that there was a basis for a suspicion that the mother knew something about the narcotic enterprise, which I would submit is not a basis to intercept conversations between even a person accused of crime and their mother, which is what it amounted to. There was a call that Geneva made to the abortion clinic, or to the, I believe it was an abortion clinic. The agents justified intercepting that call because they didn't know who she was going to talk to when she called there. Didn't occur to them, perhaps, that this might be strictly a confidential, personal, medical matter, but they intercepted the call, and they justified it on the grounds that, well, she might have been calling over there, making some inquiry about some narcotics. The pattern of the calls in this transcript were that Geneva Jenkins did not call people about narcotics to place orders for narcotics or solicit customers for narcotics. She received calls that were made to the phone for her husband. That was the pattern. The clear pattern in this case, after examining the transcripts, was that there were certain periods during the day, particularly at night, I believe from midnight until 6 in the morning, when I think there were, over the 30-day period, there might have been an average of maybe one call per day from those particular hours. And the question was put to the officers as, well, didn't you consider cutting off the wiretap, you know, minimizing the intrusion at least during the nighttime period? And it never occurred to them. Another thing that was pointed out, every call that was made from that phone, whether it be for time, whether Mr. Thurman wanted to know what time of day it was, what the weather was, these calls were, without any qualification, totally intercepted.
Of course, it's almost impossible to minimize a call for the weather, because by the time it's you finish getting the report, it would take you that long to pull the plug out, wouldn't it?
No, it isn't. No, that's not correct.
Well, Mr. Charter, you must be aware that there have been cases where conversations innocent on their surface were conversations in code related to illegal activities.
Yes, and
that's a familiar phenomenon in this business, isn't it?
Right, and there came a time, and the officers testified to it, where after listening to the calls between Bernice and some of the other alleged co-conspirators, they got to know the code that these individuals were using fairly well. Like one of the guys would always call and say, well, put me on 3rd Street, or put me on 4th Street, well, or meet me on 5th Street. He's always used a numerical reference to a street. He wasn't arranging for any meeting at 5th Street. He was telling Bernice that he wanted 5 units of narcotics. Well, this was commonly known to the agents. Another...
Yes, but new codes are constantly evolving, are they not? And it takes quite a bit of listening before they can identify a pattern.
Right. I would agree that that's so, but these people using this telephone were wedded to their own endemic kind of language. The agents, most of the agents in this case had participated in an earlier wiretap that had occurred here in the District of Columbia during the summer, the preceding summer. So they were familiar with the street language in the District of Columbia. They were also familiar by reason of having tapped the telephone involving some Spanish people, Spanish-speaking people, within the year preceding their utilizing this tap, that there were what the codes were. There was no problem about identifying the language and the codes that were used by the people in this case. And that, of course, is not what our argument about minimization deals with. If there, and we say this, that when a person became identified as an alleged co-conspirator, and first off, we have to remember the scope of the operation that this wiretap revealed. Despite what was set forth in the affidavits, the operation in this case was a retail distribution setup. When I say retail, it was purely a local distribution by one person and two lieutenants of small units of narcotics to people who would either resell them or use them. In this case, it became very questionable because some of the people who were ultimately charged were drug users, and they bought in small amounts. That was the scope of the enterprise in this case. And after a period of time, the same people were calling day in and day out, ordering small quantities of narcotics. The government had every justification in intercepting calls between the people who were identified as ordering narcotics over the telephone, and they were justified in intercepting the conversations of new people until such time as they would get some understanding of what these people might be calling about. What we complain about is clearly set forth that in the management of this wiretap, the supervision was not precise, it was not correct,
was inefficient. The supervision was inefficient.
Was inefficient, yes.
Is that enough?
No, that is not enough.
Well, what else do you have?
Well, what you have is that as not only was the supervision inefficient, but the activities of the agent was not self-correcting in terms of that inefficiency. The agents just ran an open wiretap in this case. They seized every conversation without regard to the minimization requirement.
Every
conversation, except for when the wiretap was broken or it was attached to the wrong telephone. Their instructions about lawyer-client conversations was this. This is what Agent Cooper, supervisor, said. There's a conversation between an attorney, if a lawyer calls there, somebody at that phone calls the lawyer. Listen to the conversation and learn whether they are talking about a pending case. Listen to the conversation. Then report the conversation to Mr. Sullivan, who was the supervising attorney. Then Mr. Sullivan would decide what to do next, and it got very fuzzy then. Fortunately, there were no attorney-client conversations, no attorney conversations intercepted over this telephone, but the conversation to the abortion clinic was intercepted. Telephone call from a bank to Mr. Thurman was intercepted. Calls relating to the time, the weather, and to return to the question that was asked me about.
Well, how did the time and weather hurt, and when did it hurt?
It conceivably did not hurt anyone. It was only indicative. It did not hurt anyone, certainly. It is only indicative of the fact that the agents decided to tap to just intercept all the telephone.
That the agent wasted my text
on. But the realization was, and this was sensed by the agents, that perhaps they should have exercised some caution, some they should have implemented some plan of minimization, because when they were asked as to why they seized the conversations about the weather and time and whatever, the officer's answer was, well, we listened to the conversation because we were afraid that right at the end of the conversation, they would dial someone else and they would start a narcotics conversation. That was their justification. Not that, well, these conversations don't hurt anyone. They offered another reason, which was totally false.
Because you think that's a reasonable explanation, Mr. Charter?
No, not when you have a pen register device. They had a touch tone decoder that at the time that the telephone number was dialed, assume this is the touch tone, at every plunk of every number that the caller makes, the number flashes on a board that's sitting right before the person who's running the intercept. He can see TI-4-2525. Yeah. Fast the man dials it,
What I'm getting at is this, Mr. Shorter. Is it not also a pattern in cases of this kind over the years that the first 5, 7, 10 minutes of the conversation is about the weather or cooking recipes or going fishing, and then it turns to a discussion of narcotics orders either in coded terms or in open terms? Isn't that a common pattern?
In the management of some wiretaps, yes.
And must not the agent 4 inches on that wiretap take into account that while they're talking about the weather or something else, that if he listens long enough, they'll be moving to the main topic of the narcotics business?
Yes. This frequently happens, but we're speaking about a mandated part of a statute that requires minimization. What does minimization mean? It does not mean that the agents cannot intercept telephone calls. It doesn't mean that at all. It does not mean that agents must eliminate certain calls. It means that the agents have to be responsive to the invasion of privacy that's taking place, and fashion in good faith, that's the key here, fashion in good faith some approach to the wiretapping that's going to take place. It's incumbent upon the supervising agent, the supervising attorney, and the agents to formulate some plan as to how the wiretap is going to be managed. There are illustrations throughout the cases that show that agents and officers and attorneys, supervising attorneys, who are sensitive to the invasion, the intrusion that's going to take place, do in good faith fashion such plans. And the plan consists of something more than if a lawyer gets on the phone, listen to his conversation and report it, and it consists of something more than saying, well, if there's a doctor patient conversation, don't record that. Or if the priest calls and the caller wants to make a confession over the telephone, don't record that. I'm speaking about something that is more practical, more meaningful, something more workable than just that kind of a direction to the agent. The law requires it, and the law requires that the agents, the government agents, formulate some reasonable approach to the wiretapping that they're about to do. And that means, in this particular case, some analysis, an early analysis of the telephone calls between Geneva and her mother, and particularly other phone calls between Geneva and people that she was talking to. There's an instance where she had a conversation with, I believe it's a woman called Gloria's mother, purely a very banal conversation. But the transcript of this case reflects that when Agent Cooper was asked about whether any thought was given to minimizing, that is, reducing the interception of the calls between Geneva and her mother, his answer was, well, he was asked to articulate it in terms of the guideline, this attorney-client guideline. He said, well, the guidelines that we received, and as we applied them to the case, did not have anything to do with frivolous conversations. It dealt with attorney-client conversations. So his answer, in effect, was that whatever Geneva and her mother were talking about, that was frivolous. So it's all right if we intercept that. Our guidelines concerned itself with attorney-client relationships, doctor-patient, and that kind of conversation.
Time is up, Mr. Shorter. Mr. Allen.
Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Mr. Shorter today is engaged in a discussion of the particular interceptions in this case that is not reflected in either of the briefs in the case. But in any event, Mr. Shorter has suggested, it seemed to me in his argument, a standard of what the government should have done that reflects exactly what the government did in this case. As I understood his argument, he said that when you're listening to a conversation which involves a known party to the conspiracy, the government has reason to listen to it. Then he went on to say, and by the way, I would emphasize that the record in this case reflects that every conversation that was intercepted, one of the parties to the conversation was either Petitioner Thurman or his girlfriend Geneva Jenkins, who was a co-defendant in this case, and both known conspirators, participants in the conspiracy. Mr. Shorter went on to suggest that indeed when a conversation takes place between a known participant and a stranger to the agents, it's reasonable for the agents to listen to that conversation. Now, it seems to me that if you want to get into an analysis of each particular call, that concession would cover about 95% of them, including the calls he mentioned in his argument.
Mr. Allen, do you agree that every call was intercepted?
Yes, Your Honor, except for a short period of time when the agents apparently inadvertently hooked up to the wrong phone, and we don't know how many calls were made during
that
period of time.
Does that seem to support his argument that there was no discretionary?
No, Your Honor, I believe it does not.
I mean, I think every single call.
That's right, but I think all it reflects is that it was reasonable to intercept every single call.
Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. Among other things, the agents at the time, and after the fact, it seems to be true that 40% of the calls were clearly narcotics-related.
Well, after the fact doesn't help me.
All right.
Because if you take a baseball bat and crack a man's head and look at it and find dope, that justifies cracking his skull.
Well, Your Honor, we're not engaging in that kind of analysis.
All right.
We're trying to decide whether it's reasonable.
My point is, the statute says use some discretion, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And here they use none.
Your Honor, here they intercepted every call.
Well, doesn't that tend to say that no discretion was used?
No, Mr. Justice Marshall, I don't think it does. There's a fundamental logical fallacy in that conclusion, which is one that the district court engaged in. In other words, consider the simplest case where all they've intercepted is one call, and it's a clearly narcotics-related call. Now, would you say in that case that that's evidence that the agent hasn't used any discretion?
It has nothing to do with my question. It's no one call here.
There are 384
That's
calls,
right.
all
That's
of which
a lot different from one.
All of which our analysis indicates.
All of which had to do with dope. Like
no, Your Honor. Not all of which had to
like
do with
what?
Dope, but all of which were reasonably intercepted on the anticipation that they might have something to do with dope.
So
with
on,
a reasonable
on the
anticipation.
Weather one, the weather one would be a frame up or something?
Well, the weather calls stand by themselves, and I understand that there were As I understand it, there were very few of those, perhaps five or six. There were perhaps 20 calls to find out what time it was, which is about a five-minute call, and the agent has barely time to turn off the machine. The weather calls are, again, very short calls, and the agents, it's our position that the agents were not unreasonable in concluding that listening to a very short weather call, where by the time you take off your headphones and turn off the machine, the call is going to be over. The agents, it seems to us, are reasonable in concluding that they weren't.
Was anything in my question about taking off anything my question involving hitting the switch.
Well, it's more, it's, all right, even turning off the recorder. By the time they reach over to turn off the recorder, the call is...
Well, why in the world did they put this provision in this statute?
They put the provision in the statute, and it's and we for don't for a moment belittle the importance of the provision. They put the provision in the statute to accommodate very important individual interests in privacy. Listening to a recorded weather call that anyone can listen to simply does not infringe upon anyone's privacy, Your Honor.
Well, why didn't the statute say that? The statute doesn't say that, does it?
Well, the statute didn't purport to enumerate all of the infinite circumstances in which an agent, infinite kinds of calls which an agent might.
You think we should?
No, Your Honor. I think we have to look and see whether the conduct of the agents was reasonable and whether it violated the kinds of things the statute was designed to.
Do you think that where you turn a listening device on 24 hours a day for 30 days, that that's okay?
It is okay, Your Honor, if all of the calls that came through and they were listening to, they had reasonable grounds for listening to.
Did you tell us that every call intercepted involved on one end of the line one or the other of the two defendants in the case?
That is correct. One of either Ernest Thornton, who was a petitioner, or his girlfriend, who was a co-defendant, was on the line.
Wouldn't that usually happen when you tap somebody's phone that most of the time you hear him?
That's correct, Your Honor, and in cases where you hear him, you have greater reason to listen to his conversation or some greater portion of it than you do when you listen to a 10-year-old daughter.
Yet in the case that we heard several years ago, the evidence showed that there were numerous calls to the tap number where the person answering the phone was not the person residing in that place, but someone else there taking orders of narcotics.
I think that case was the man's wife in Chicago.
I don't recall the case right offhand,
but when it's a business enterprise, as in the narcotics business is, it would not be unusual to have some relief.
But that's correct, Your Honor, and that's
one answering the phone to take orders.
That's right. It seems to us that that's something an agent can reasonably take into account. But in any event, in this case, the agents from the beginning knew that Petitioner Thurman was the target of the tap, and after a few days, they knew that his girlfriend was taking orders for him. The principal issue in this case, as we've been discussing, is whether the agents violated the minimization requirements in Judge Smith's orders. Now, as I understand petitioners' arguments, their argument is essentially as follows, that the minimization requirement of the statute imposes a two-pronged test, both of which must be met before any interception is lawful. The first prong is, according to the petitioners, that the agents engage in what they call good faith efforts at minimization. And the second prong is that the interceptions be objectively reasonable. Although they also assert that the interceptions in this case were not objectively reasonable, they have relied almost exclusively on the argument that there were no good faith efforts in this case to minimize. Our response to their argument about good faith efforts is twofold. We have two independent responses. Our first position is a legal position, that the alleged good faith or lack of good faith subjective good faith of the agents conducting an interception is not a determining factor in deciding whether they have complied with the statute and the minimization orders. Our second position is a factual position, that is, that the record in this case simply does not support the claim that the agents in this case had bad faith or subjectively intended to violate the provisions of Judge Smith's orders, including the minimization provision. Now, the first issue, which is a legal issue, has importance beyond the facts of this case and should be discussed first, if not principally. The legal question, as I suggested to Mr. Justice Marshall, it seems to us can perhaps best be put in focus by considering the simplest case. You have agents who obtain a court order to intercept conversations based on probable cause that John Smith, the owner of the telephone, the subscriber to the telephone, is engaging in his narcotics business over that telephone. And they obtain a court order, and the court order provides, pursuant to the statute, that the interception shall be conducted in such a way as to minimize the interception of conversations not otherwise subject to the statute. The order, say, is for 5 days, and they obtain, and during that period, there's one call that comes over the phone. And that's a call from John Smith, and he starts right off talking about his narcotics business, and they listen to it and they intercept it. Now, suppose later on there's a suppression hearing, and the agent testifies that his supervisor instructed him to listen to everything that came over the line. Now, as I understand the petitioner's position, they would contend that the interception of that call, which we would submit is clearly reasonable, is nevertheless unlawful because the agent who intercepted it would probably have intercepted some other call that was never made in different circumstances. Now, it's our position, it's our central position, that there's simply no basis in the statute or in general principles of search and seizure law for that position. We can't see any basis for arguing that that agent, in my example, failed, in the words of the statute, quote, to minimize the interception of communications not otherwise subject to interception.
But, Mr. Allen, supposing the judge's order had left out any command to minimize and said, go ahead and intercept everything, and then they'd only intercepted one and been proper, would that have been a proper...
No, Your Honor, I don't think it would, because the statute provides as one of the grounds for suppression the allegation that the order is defective on its face, and in your hypothetical, the order would be defective on its face. In other words, the interception that resulted from that order would have resulted from a defective order.
Can you give me an example of a violation of a minimization order written in the words of the statute that would result in suppression?
Yes. Suppose, for instance, the agents have an order to investigate my John Smith example, and he's out one night, and he has a 12-year-old babysitter, and she makes a call to her boyfriend, and the agents have no reason to believe that she has anything to do or any knowledge with the operation, but nevertheless, out of curiosity, to call. And by happenstance, the babysitter says, well, you know, my boss, Mr. Smith, left some narcotics over here. We would admit that in that circumstance it was unreasonable for the agent to listen to the conversation, and the evidence that happened to develop from it ought to be suppressed.
In other words, you're applying a sort of probable cause test that when the babysitter is calling her boyfriend, there's no probable cause, in quotation marks, to believe that they're going to talk about narcotics. Is that it? Something like that?
Well, I wouldn't put the label probable cause on it.
In quotation marks.
Well, I would prefer to use the word they had no reasonable expectation that their interception would be relevant or the conversation would be relevant. As I say, our position is fundamentally that good faith and lack of good faith cannot be a relevant consideration. It's true under the statute, and it's true as a general matter of Fourth Amendment law.
Well, suppose a 12-year-old had called an abortion clinic. And before you answer that, you know this woman did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was a little over 12.
If the 12-year-old in my example had called an abortion clinic, the agent would have improperly intercepted
but
it.
This one, so
if Geneva Jenkins, who is a co-defendant and a participant in the conspiracy, had made a call to some organization that had never come up in the tap before, I suggest that it's not unreasonable for the agents to listen to a very short conversation.
Say that if you file the proper papers, you can get a tap on any person's wire for everything?
If the statute said that, I think it would be unconstitutional.
And if they did it, would it be equally as unconstitutional?
No doubt about it.
Well, isn't that what happened in this case?
No, Your Honor. In this case, the
they listened to everything. I thought you said that.
They listened to everything in circumstances that made listening to everything reasonable.
But they listened to everything.
That's correct, Your Honor. In circumstances that made it reasonable.
The circumstances were that they were the guilty people.
Pardon me?
They were the guilty people. Is that the reason?
No, Your Honor. They're guilty reason. The reason was that the conversations they were listening to were either narcotics-related, they were always by somebody who was involved in the conspiracy, and they were either narcotics-related or they were sufficiently ambiguous to give the agent some reason. Let me give you an example. Agent Cooper, who was the primary witness in the suppression hearing, testified that he conducted this interception on the basis on the same basis that he conducted another interception recently. And he said that, for instance, in that interception, we had a case where two people, a woman who was talking over the phone, would always call her friend, and when she called a particular friend, she would always talk about her illness. Well, after a time or two of that, we stopped intercepting that kind of conversation. I mean, we had developed reason to believe that the interception of that conversation wouldn't help our investigation. Seems to me that is the reasonable way to go about it.
So that if the agent says, one time we heard him talk to the guy who said he was his lawyer, and we didn't listen anymore, we found out it wasn't his lawyer, it was his pusher. So now we're going to listen to lawyers too.
No, Your Honor, I don't think in this case, it was clear that one thing they weren't going to listen to was calls to lawyers.
Why didn't they tell the judge that?
Pardon me?
They didn't tell the judge that when they got the warrant. They got the order. They didn't tell the judge that. Did they tell the judge they were going to hear everything, that they were going to listen to every conversation?
They told the judge, implicitly, they told the judge when they applied to the order that they wanted an order to intercept conversations that contained information about the narcotics conspiracy. Implicitly, they told the judge that they would act reasonably, which, in our view, they did.
Mr. Allen, let me go back to your 12-year-old babysitter. Would you say they should not listen to the first conversation of the babysitter? Your example of the illness by the other person, they listened two or three times and decided they'd identified a pattern.
Well, it would depend on the circumstances.
Well, a babysitter,
it seems to me the first, as a general presumption, I would. It seems to me that a conversation between a 12-year-old babysitter and her 13-year-old boyfriend,
how do you know
it seems to me, although there may be circumstances to the contrary, that kind of conversation is not going to be relevant.
Maybe they have the 12-year-old answer the phone and they develop a pattern, having the 12-year-old answer the phone, talk for a couple of minutes,
maybe,
and then turn the phone over to the parents who are going to talk about drugs.
What happens
and how are you going to avoid that sort of thing if you say that as soon as you hear a minute of a juvenile conversation, we turn it off?
Well, it would depend on the circumstances. I think in some circumstances it may be reasonable to listen to a juvenile's conversation.
What about the 32-year-old babysitter?
The 32-year-old babysitter in this case was a participant in the conspiracy.
No, I mean in the case you're talking about.
Oh, a 32-year-old babysitter? Yeah. Well, it would depend. If you knew it was a babysitter, and you knew she had nothing to do or no knowledge of the conspiracy, then probably you ought to turn it off, though there may be circumstances in which you can listen to it.
More and more you convince me the Congress just should not have put that in, Mr.
The minimization?
Just let you go.
The minimization requirement?
Yes.
But the trouble is, Congress did put it.
Well, some of the judges on the Court of Appeals, and Mr. Justice Brennan and Mr. Justice Marshall, have expressed concern that if our position concerning that the proper standard should be objective reasonableness were adopted, there would be a danger that interceptions would then be validated by what they turn up. We submit that that concern is certainly understandable, but that it doesn't accurately reflect our position or the analysis the Court of Appeals engaged in this case. It doesn't reflect our position because, as I was stating to Mr. Justice Stevens, our position is simply that the reasonableness of interceptions has to be based on what is going on at the time, and that if it is unreasonable for an agent to listen to conversations in view of what he is, all of the inputs, sensory inputs on him, then if by chance it turns up evidence, it's our position that evidence should be suppressed. And that essentially is the analysis that the Court of Appeals engaged in this case. And essentially, it's no different than any analysis where the courts try to decide, for example, whether a policeman was justified in arresting someone or stopping and frisking someone on the basis of the circumstances at the time, even though that person may wind up to have a contraband or weapons on it. Apart from our legal position,
As to standing, are you going to rely on your brief?
Essentially, Your Honor, we will rely on our brief as to standing unless the court has any questions about it. Apart from our legal position, our factual response to the petitioner's claim about lack of good faith efforts is that the record simply doesn't support the claim that the agents here acted in bad faith or intended to ignore their minimization obligations. We have cited in our brief the testimony of Agent Cooper to the effect that he was aware of the minimization requirements, that he instructed his agents with respect to them, that he never instructed his agents to listen to every call, and that if they had heard calls that appeared to be unlikely to relate to the investigation, they would have turned them off. And I won't burden the court with recitations to this transcript, but I would only point out that the petitioner's claim to the contrary and the district court's finding to the contrary is based on a logical fallacy. That is, it's based on testimony that doesn't logically support the conclusion. For example, to take the simple example of the case where over the period of the intercept, only one conversation is intercepted, and it happens to be reasonable to intercept it because it's clearly crime-related. Suppose the agent in that case at a suppression hearing had been asked repeatedly, as Agent Cooper was asked in this case, well, did you ever make any efforts to minimize the interception of conversations? Did you ever consider your minimization obligations? Can you point to any instance in which you exercised discretion that resulted in the non-recordation as a discretionary matter as to what was overheard? If the agent in my example had given negative answers to that question, that wouldn't reflect that he was operating in bad faith. It would only reflect that he intercepted the only call that came over the line. And that is essentially the basis for the petitioner's claim on bad faith and the basis for the district court's analysis. If the court accepts our position that the proper standard is objective reasonableness, the question remains whether the interceptions in this case were objectively reasonable. Now, in their briefs, the petitioners don't seriously challenge the Court of Appeals' conclusion that it was objectively reasonable to intercept all of the calls in this case. And they don't point, to any calls that shouldn't have been intercepted or any reasons as to why they shouldn't have been intercepted. The court may be interested in the question of more generally of the general considerations that apply to determining whether interceptions are reasonable or not reasonable. And at the outset, I want to stress again that it's not our intent to belittle the importance of the statutory minimization requirements. We recognize that they're designed to serve and accommodate important individual interests in privacy. But how those interests can best be implemented in each particular case often poses some very difficult problems. Now, the Court of Appeals started with a proposition that seems clearly correct to us, that the very nature of interceptions that are authorized and limited by the statute requires monitoring agents to listen to at least some portion of every call before they can make any judgment as to the likelihood that the call is going to be relevant or irrelevant. Now, how much of the call may then be reasonably intercepted depends on a wide variety of circumstances, including what the agents know about the callers, the scope of the criminal enterprise, the degree of coded language employed in the call, and so forth. And many of those considerations can be applied only after the agents have been able to develop some patterns among the calls. Now, the courts of appeals have developed a number of relevant factors, including those I've just mentioned. But it'd be impossible to enumerate an exhaustive list. In some kinds of cases, it may be possible for agents to develop more or less formal procedures or guidelines with respect to how they're going to go about an intercept. For example, in a gambling case, if they have reason to believe that John Smith is conducting his gambling business from a certain telephone, from his residential phone, but has three small children or three teenage children, it may be possible for the agents to develop guidelines that say don't listen to the calls of the children, but listen to the calls of John Smith, because in a gambling case, most of those kinds of calls are simply calls are where the caller calls in and places a bet right off the bat. They go right to the business. In other kinds of cases, like narcotics, especially, particularly like narcotics conspiracies, where there are many unknown participants and where one caller is always a known participant, it's much more difficult for the agents to establish guidelines, and they may have to rely on an ad hoc judgments about the nature of the calls they're listening to. And this case, I think, reflects that narcotics conspiracies are present some unique difficulties to agents conducting interceptions under the statute. In narcotics conspiracies, at least like this case, it's very typical that the beginning portion of the conversation is largely ambiguous or irrelevant, and then the participants may refer to a suit of clothes, which means a delivery of narcotics. So it's very difficult, much more difficult in this kind of case, for agents to decide with any great degree of certainty what kind of conversation they're listening to, or to apply any formal procedures with respect to when to turn them off. With respect to the additional issues in this case concerning the scope of the suppression remedy and the standing of Petitioner Scott, we rely primarily on the arguments we've addressed in the brief. I would only emphasize here our response to the petitioner's argument that if, as we contend, the statute only requires the suppression of conversations that should not have been intercepted because they're irrelevant, then agents will not be deterred from listening to every conversation. That argument seems to us to misconceive the traditional purpose of the exclusionary rule, which is not to punish police, but rather to remove their incentives to commit unlawful acts. Our position is fully consistent with that traditional purpose. Any interception that should not have been intercepted should be suppressed, thereby removing the agent's incentive to intercept communications in violation of minimization requirements. But beyond that, there is even less reason in this context, or need in this context, to expand the suppression remedy, because this statute, unlike most Fourth Amendment contexts, imposes significant affirmative sanctions on officers who violate their statutory obligations in bad faith, civil and criminal sanctions.
Of course, there's a way to read this statute, Mr. Allen, as a question a while ago by my brother Stevens indicated, that would make it both semantically meaningless as well as as practically meaningless, because the statute says imposes an obligation to conduct the surveillance in such a way as to minimize the interception of communications not otherwise subject to interception under this chapter, and all the communications are otherwise subject to interception under this chapter, under the court order.
Arguably, Your Honor, although the statute specifically exempts, I believe, privileged conversations.
Yes, everything except evidentiary privileged conversations.
That is a possible way to read the statute, Your Honor.
Grammatically, that is the way to read it, isn't it?
That's correct. We wouldn't rely on that reading. It seems to us that the purpose of the statute read as a whole is to authorize only certain kinds of interceptions of certain kinds of conversations, and that was probably what the minimization provision was referring to. That is, if you receive an authorization to intercept, to obtain narcotics conversations, it seems to us the statute probably meant that you weren't supposed to receive, to intercept, or you're supposed to make reasonable efforts to minimize the interception of non-relevant conversations.
John, do you rely at all on an argument, I don't know if it's been made or not, that you're investigating people who are going to be potential defendants in a criminal trial? Presumably they may come up with some kind of an alibi defense, or they may come up with stories that would try to explain ambiguous transactions, and that even though a particular conversation is not crime-related, it may give you information in the nature of a diary or something about the trial that would help you at the trial.
We would contend, Your Honor, that the authorization under a court order extends to the interception of communications for the purpose of developing evidence relevant to the investigation.
Including impeaching evidence, potentially impeaching evidence?
I should think so, Your Honor, although I'd want to think about that a little longer.
Or foreseeing a possible defense in a criminal trial, such as an alibi? if he says I was visiting.
Well, I think in certain circumstances that might be
Tuesday
reasonable.
Afternoon, you can say, well, as a matter of fact, you were on the telephone talking to your butcher.
In certain circumstances that might be reasonable, although I wouldn't want to take it too far, because that if you took that too far, you could intercept everything.
Exactly.
You generally don't know what a person is going to say by way of alibi until the trial begins.
Well, that's right. But we wouldn't contend that the statute should be construed to let us intercept everything for any reason. Only for reasonable reasons.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.